It is November the 25th on Monday, and I am bringing you the readings from the Herald and Review for Monday, starting with page 1. Race Relations reads the headline. Group holds bi-monthly meetings to spark meaningful conversation. Bruce Porter was raised in Salem, a predominantly white community. It was lily white, he said. His first encounter with another race was in college, decades ago. My parents told me nothing about black people, he said. They didn't incorporate any racism into me. I developed my own attitude, which was to take people as you find them. There's good and bad in every race. Don't make generalizations. When Porter decided to attend a local discussion on race, he went, hoping he could contribute. But I have learned things, Porter said. We all want to be better people. The bi-monthly meetings, Real Talk on Race, are held at the Decatur Public Library. The objective is to learn more about each other. Dave Draves leads the group with his wife, Lethea. This isn't going to instantly solve all the world's problems, he said of the meetings. This is about something that is missing and that has meaningful conversations. The meetings were created nearly 2 years ago under the original name, Racial Taboo, after a documentary film. We wanted to try and find out why it was uncomfortable to sit down and have conversations about race, Lethea Draves said. Continuing the conversations is the important aspect of the meetings. Less than a year ago, the current group decided to change the name of the meetings to reflect the healthy discussions. The new title, Real Talk on Race, has drawn to the Thursday meetings. The Decatur Public Library is an active partner, helping to promote the group. The free meetings may feature a film, but will always have conversations. The Draves begin each meeting with a reminder of the rules of engagement, which include guidelines such as no bashing of individuals or groups, no naming of names, and listen to understand. We built our rules of engagement through experience, Lethea Draves said. The discussions may include history of race relations, samples of racism, and the effects of social media. We also talk about the definition of racism because we don't always agree on that, Lethea Draves said. If you don't agree on it, then our conversations can have more conflict. A group of about 10 people of various races attend each meeting. Kabedi Mulamede, 23, has been attending the meetings for almost 2 years. I love social awareness, social justice, and equality, she said, and I love the fact that this gives us a safe space to talk about so many issues that are so hard to talk about normally, or people don't want to talk about because it's scary. Brenda Major has encouraged others to join the meeting, particularly if they want to do some self-discovery, she said, to really examine their own beliefs, how they view race or their own race, or interact with other races. As an African-American woman, Major admits that she can be protective of her race. You can delude yourself into thinking everybody is against you because you are the minority, she said, but that lets you off the hook for what you think about yourself and how you think of other people and how you are projecting your wrong thinking onto other people. Major believes her thinking has progressed since she began attending the meetings more than a year ago. I'm listening and understanding and then turning it back on myself, she said. But we all came from different levels of comfort, said Dorothy McFadden Parker. Throughout their time together, the group has come to trust each other. There is a safety in discussion, said Clooney John. People listened and contributed as they are comfortable. Julie Van Dielen admits that before she attended the meeting, she thought her ideas on race were clear and understandable. I have this big heart, and I'm open to everyone, she said. And then I realized there is this nuance. It's like learning a language, but only learning from a textbook. You need to get with people and start talking about it. The members agree the meetings are not designed for activism. We are here to grow first and then take our growth out into the community in our own individual ways, Van Dielen said. If you go, it is called Real Talk on Race. It is held at 6 p.m. on the first and third Thursdays at the Decatur Public Library on Franklin Street, and there is no cost for these discussions. And on health, efforts to increase flu shot rates fall short, by Phil Galowitz. It's free and available everywhere, yet most Americans skip the annual flu shot. With the number of dispensed vaccines barely changed in the past decade, despite government removal of cost and access obstacles. We are kind of spinning our wheels trying to reach a larger portion of the population, said Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Public health officials recommend that nearly all people get the flu shot. The 2010 Affordable Care Act required all insurers to waive out-of-pocket costs for plan members for the vaccinations, and in the past few years, all states allow pharmacists to administer the shots, which have made them available in drugstores, grocery chains, and big box stores. The flat immunization rates worry public health officials who say the vaccine is the best weapon to prevent the flu, which causes as many as 61,000 deaths during the last flu season and hundreds of hospitalizations. The number of Americans being vaccinated is not optimal, Dr. Daniel Jernigan, director of the influenza division at the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee this week. A key reason people choose not to get the flu vaccine is that they perceive it doesn't work, Jernigan said, although studies have found it is usually 40-60% effective. CDC and other officials at the hearing stressed that even when the vaccine doesn't prevent infection, it reduces complications that land people in the hospital and cause death. About 45% of adults received the flu shot last year, up from about 41% in 2010, according to CDC data. Immunization rates have stayed in the 40-45% range for the past decade. Among people 65 and older who are most at risk for complication of the flu, 68% were inoculated last year, up from 67% in 2010. Vaccination rates, however, have risen for children, increasing to 73% last year from 64% in 2011. While getting a flu shot generally takes less than 10 minutes, most of that time just filling out forms, having to get the immunization each year makes it challenging compared with other vaccinations, which can last a decade or more. Public health officials remake the flu vaccine each year to keep up with its constantly mutating versions of the virus. The federal government is working on creating a long-acting flu vaccine that can work against all known strains of the virus, but it's at least several years away. The first human testing began on a small scale this year at the National Institutes of Health. Another factor that limits people from getting vaccinated is that they don't realize how dangerous flu and its complications, such as pneumonia, can be. There is a perception that flu is a little worse than the common cold, and there is not a huge level of worry, said Dr. Jeff Salvan-Harmon, Chief Patient Safety Officer at Presbyterian Healthcare Services, an integrated health plan in New Mexico with 590,000 health plan members. People with flu often have high fever and muscle aches that make even the healthiest individuals feel tired for up to a week. And also on the front page, farmers look to the future. Some see the trend of go big or get out shifting by Adam Belts. The U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue appeared to be delivering hard truth to the Heartland last month when he said he wasn't sure family dairies would survive. Consolidation has been the driving force on agriculture for decades, and Perdue's comments reflect that reality. In America, the big get bigger and the small go out, Perdue said at a dairy exposition in Wisconsin. But not everyone agrees the trend will continue unabated. Conventional agriculture that emphasizes economies of scale faces its own fundamental weaknesses, and several forces are reshaping the future of farming in ways that may favor the small. There is a very strong future for family farms, said Russell Diaz Canseco, CEO of Vital Farms, an umbrella company for independent egg farms in 9 states. Small farmers and people like Diaz Canseco, who work with them, describe an industry that's evolving and in which they are well positioned to meet demand for new types of food and other crops. Younger farmers are less interested in fence row to fence row crop production. Consumers want a more direct relationship with their food. Alternative crops such as hemp that can be grown on small acreages at a profit are gaining ground in the marketplace. Large-scale corn and soybean farmers are more productive than ever, but their livelihood depends on the government. Corn prices are propped up by ethanol mandates, for instance. Soybean growers are worried they will never fully recover a Chinese market that has been decimated by the trade war and a disease that wiped out many pigs in that country. More than a third of the U.S. farm income in 2019 is expected to come from the government. Meanwhile, the inputs for corn and soybean production are depleting and becoming more expensive. Farmers must contend with weeds and insects increasingly resistant to herbicides and pesticides, for instance. And the government system designed to support those crops has encouraged farmers to grow too much of them. A huge amount of public policies are supporting keeping the current system going, and what that's leading to is overproduction, which is one of our problems, said Fred Kirschenmann, a fellow at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University, who manages an organic farm in North Dakota. On top of all that, the men and women who run conventional farms are aging out of the business, and the younger people interested in farming are eager to try something different if they are able to buy or rent land. To Kirschenmann, it all means that an era in which farmers relied on non-renewable inputs like oil and rock phosphate to wrest the maximum number of calories from the ground is coming to a close. There are examples of farmers already beginning to transition to a different kind of future that can be successful, Kirschenmann said. In my conversations with the young farmers who are aged 30 and 40, they don't want to do the input-intensive commodity agriculture. Helping those young farmers figure out a business model that works well will take effort and investment, Kirschenmann said. But even redirecting a small percentage of the subsidies for conventional corn and soybeans to that project could help. The transition that Kirschenmann hopes for would be a seismic shift. Most small farmers were squeezed out of hog, poultry, and cattle production by the late 1990s. Conventional corn and soybean farming falls to fewer farmers each year as growers retire and their land is snapped up by larger farms nearby. Dairy had been until recently the consolidation holdout, with thousands of smaller farms across Minnesota and Wisconsin, but massive dairies, even in Minnesota, are now taking a larger share of the milk market, and family dairies face existential crises. That hasn't stopped some in farming from being bullish about a future where crops aimed at consumer niches can succeed. Diaz Canseco leads a business that was created as an alternative to large-scale farming. Demand for pasture-raised eggs is growing faster than demand for eggs from chickens kept in huge confinement buildings, he said. The key for a small family farm with limited access to capital is to farm in a way that doesn't compete directly with those parts of our food system which are driven by scale economics, Diaz Canseco said. Vital Farms accepts that reality itself, for instance, by packing all its farmers' eggs at a central packing facility. The company also recognizes how difficult it is for smaller farmers to navigate government programs and subsidies. We coordinate and manage all the complex paperwork and inspections that are required to sell eggs in this country. Most small farms wouldn't have the expertise, Diaz Canseco said. A major role that the Secretary of Agriculture has is ensuring a safe and abundant food system for the United States and our citizens, but all that I would ask for is a level playing field for our farmers, regardless of size. Residents report gunfire by Tony Reed. Police said 9/11 dispatchers in Decatur could hear the sound of multiple gunshots as worried residents called in to report weapons fire in their neighborhood early Saturday. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland with Decatur Police said that officers were sent to the 600 block of East Grand Avenue just after 3:50 a.m. after callers told them there was a crowd gathered in the street and gunshots were ringing out from their vicinity. Copeland said the crowd had already started to disperse by vehicle and on foot as police arrived. Officers could find no sign of anyone being hit, and hospitals reported treating no one for gunshot wounds. They also found no bullet damage to surrounding buildings or cars. Officers spoke with an area resident who said she was asleep and awakened by sound of 4 to 5 gunshots, Copeland added. Officers checked the area and found 6 9mm shell casings in the North Alley in the 600 block of East Grand. No arrests were made. Food baskets fill a need. 1,000 volunteers take part in 25th Judy Mason Thanksgiving Project by Tony Reed. From Forsyth, grade school teacher Chrissy Patterson was busy teaching her own children a seasonal lesson Sunday afternoon. It's far better to give than to receive. She could not have picked a more appropriate classroom as daughter Charlotte, 8, and Avery, 6, helped mom fill boxes with food during the 25th Judy Mason Thanksgiving Basket Project. I want to show them it's good to help other people, said Patterson, who lives in Mount Zion and teaches in Atwood. Not everyone has food or can just go to the store and buy food for Thanksgiving dinner. And I know that a lot of kids don't have much food at home. Their only meal is usually at school. So, Mom and the girls got busy filling box after box with 18 food items, including pasta, canned goods, dried scalloped potatoes, and on, with a 5-pound pre-cooked ham to be added before distribution today. All around them, the bustling scene was like Santa's workshop on an industrial scale. The basket project had taken over the cavernous Hickory Point mall space left behind the departed Sears, and it was busier than Sears' wildest retail dreams. An estimated 1,000 volunteers filling 4,000 boxes. Some 60 organizations scattered throughout Decatur and Macon County, ranging from churches to food pantries, know who the needy are in their communities and will handle the final distribution. The whole thing was started by a Decatur couple, Terry Mason and his late wife, Judy, who got the idea rolling through their church and began with 7 laundry baskets filled with food. Looking around at the ranks of boxes and laughing volunteers filling them, many are family groups who make this the start of their holiday season, Terry Mason grows a little wistful. "It is sad that we need to do this," he said, "but we do need to do it. The need is out there." Julia Livingston, the event organizer, said it costs $100,000 in hectic fundraising to fill the boxes and said they have to limit them to stay within an already vast budget. Asked if there was a need for, say, 2,000 more boxes, she said yes, probably, and Mesa noted, "I would agree with that wholeheartedly," he added. "But it is, each box is carefully packed with love and a hand-decorated card." Volunteer Carla Sloan, who has been taking part for 20 years, said a card is slipped inside that was hand-drawn by grade school children. "It was Julia's idea," she said. "It gives each box a personal touch, and hopefully the teachers told the children why they were making the card." Police say a 15-year-old was shot in the leg by Tony Reed. Police are investigating after a 15-year-old Decatur male showed up to the hospital Sunday evening with a gunshot wound to the leg. Sergeant Eric Ethel with Decatur Police said that the male was dropped off at Decatur Memorial Hospital at just after 6 p.m., and initial reports from doctors said the wound was not thought to be life-threatening. "He has provided a statement as to what happened, and we're trying to follow up on that right now," said Ethel, speaking about 7:15 p.m. He said he did not want to comment further on the circumstances of the shooting while the investigation was active. Ethel also confirmed the police had received calls earlier in the evening from residents saying they had heard shots fired in the area of North Hayworth Avenue and West Williams Street, but said he couldn't say if those reports were connected with the gunshot victim. "We don't know if they are related at this point," he added. Anyone with information can call police at 424-2734 or Crime Stoppers at 423-8477. Coroner identifies woman killed after the fire, Allison Petty. The Macon County Coroner's Office says an 87-year-old woman died of carbon monoxide intoxication after an SUV crashed into her Decatur home and caused a house fire. Chief Deputy Coroner D. Coventry said in a statement that preliminary autopsy results showed that Mary D. Hinton died after inhaling smoke and soot from the fire. She was pronounced dead at 1:54 a.m. Saturday. The Decatur Police and Decatur Fire Department previously said they both responded shortly after 11 p.m. to the incident in the 2300 block of East Locust Street. Authorities arrived to find the home engulfed in flames. Hinton was found dead inside after the fire was put out, the fire department said. Police said their initial investigation indicated that the vehicle was eastbound before it left the roadway and struck the house. Its 17-year-old male driver was taken to a hospital for his injuries and was later arrested for driving under the influence and other pending charges. An inquest and investigation are pending. And other briefs on the police blotter by Tony Reed. Man shot, police investigating. Police are trying to unravel the story of how a 23-year-old Decatur man came to be shot in the leg Friday afternoon. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland with the Decatur Police said the man had arrived in the emergency room of HSHS St. Mary's with a bullet wound to his left leg, the wound positioned about halfway between his foot and his knee. "He gave us conflicting stories about what happened," added Copeland. The detective said officers went to the 1000 block of East Prairie Avenue based on information from the man and recovered a single spent shell casing. The man did not name any suspects and told police he had no idea how or why the shooting happened. Police window shattered by BB gun. A Decatur woman told police the picture window in her home on Northland Drive was shot out by a BB gun on Friday. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland with the Decatur Police said the 56-year-old woman said the damage was done sometime between 6:15 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Friday and valued the window at $400. Arcola man dies in collision with a truck. State police said a male pedestrian was killed early Saturday when he was struck by a pickup truck while walking southbound in the westbound lane of the East Springfield Road in Arcola. A news statement from Trooper Joseph Rush named the pedestrian as 85-year-old Curtis Atterbury of Arcola. Rush said the collision occurred at 6:25 a.m. and the truck involved was driven by Patrick Bell, 18, from Brockton. Atterbury had been pronounced dead at the scene by the Douglas County Coroner's Office, which is investigating the death along with the police. Rush did not list Bell as being injured and said no tickets had been issued in the wake of the incident. And this article from At Work, Survey, Colleagues May Be More Vital Than Perks and Benefits, by Brittany Mealing. With the rise of workplace perks like unlimited paid vacation and flexible work-from-home policies, it would be fair to assume freedom and autonomy are of utmost importance to today's workers. But in a survey of San Diego's top workplaces, happy employees were more likely to report that people, colleagues, mentors, bosses, or workplace friends were the reason they loved their work. Relationships with colleagues have always played a role in workplace satisfaction, but experts say it's possible these office relationships are more critical today than they once were. Thanks to the technology-fueled modern lifestyle, people are experiencing more social isolation than in years past. With younger generations, church has fallen out of style, dinner parties have died, and neighbors are just strangers who live next door. Human interaction is even being removed from daily life tasks like ordering lunch and shopping for groceries. A new feature of the Uber app even lets riders request that the drivers not speak to them at all. We've lost many forums, churches, and places where we had more time to discover meaningful relationships, said Dan Negroni, a talent development consultant in San Diego. Gone are the days of apprenticeship and mentorship for learning. Now we're self-learning through platforms like YouTube. For many adults, that leaves one daily institution for them to form social bonds, the workplace. And employers should take note because these social connections should be a meaningful contributor to worker performance, satisfaction, and retention. What happens when you have friends at work? There's an extensive body of research dating back to the 1980s that shows workplace friendships reduce turnover and absenteeism, as well as boosting feelings of job security, comfort, and job satisfaction. Employees with friends at work also tend to engage in altruistic behaviors by providing coworkers with help, guidance, advice, or feedback with various work-related matters. Peer-reviewed research published in the journal American Psychologist also suggests that companies can benefit from such friendships as these workers help each other and communicate well. Both of these behaviors can increase effort and production. Negroni said that startups and other modern companies aren't off base by offering free lunches, kombucha on tap, and video games in the break room. It's not about the perks, it's about the social gatherings that they inspire. The frat environment may actually work, Negroni said. A Cornell study showed that workplaces are more productive if people eat together. Employers don't do this because millennials are entitled and want the perk. They're doing it because we connect by sharing meals. At Shield AI, a robotics startup in San Diego, CEO Ryan Tseng said that the company was very deliberate in creating their culture. Their company values, which include being kind and trustworthy, are regularly discussed at meetings. In the Union Tribune's workplace survey, administered in conjunction with Philadelphia-based Energage to determine San Diego County's top workplaces, most of Shield's AI employees mentioned their colleagues as the reason they love their jobs. Full results of the top workplace survey will publish online Sunday morning. It comes down to the people. All the people I work with are amazing, one anonymous employee wrote. Truly a team work-oriented culture where everyone goes out of their way to help each other succeed. And this editorial column by Liz Ryer. Take ownership of your contributions to the company. It is annual review time and I am overdue for a promotion. As I do my self-assessment, I wonder about the best way to position my value while I write up my submission. I don't like to look braggy, so I'm worried that I undersell myself. And that was written by Kim 39, who's a finance analyst. And the answer: start with a list of contributions you have made over the past year. This may not be as easy as it sounds. For one thing, memories fade, and for another, it sounds like you may tend to underestimate the value you bring. To get a jump start, try working backward through your most recent projects. Make a much longer list than you'll actually share, just to build momentum. Refer to your calendar, looking at meetings you had and people you engaged with. Then enrich the story of what happened in each situation. You might start with a simple statement, "I completed analysis X." Go on to explain why this mattered. How did it help someone? Keep the business perspective front and center. Be sure you know your company's goals so that you can make statements like, "By completing analysis X, I enabled the team to reach its goal of one of our company's key revenue objectives." Your statements about your value should lead the reader to conclude that you already are performing at a higher level. When you write up your self-review, you can use the business perspective and the future-looking perspective to frame your input. Bring in the voice of your customer. Do you have quotes you could take from thank you emails or other feedback from internal or external clients? Use them sparingly, perhaps only alluding to the direct positive feedback you have received, but be ready to share them in more detail. Use strong, direct language. Avoid passive phrasing and employ action verbs that communicate your integral role. Get feedback on your draft from someone who understands your work. In particular, ask them to point out gaps and push you to courageously own the value you bring. Once your content is complete, get a good polish on it. If you are given a format, make sure that everything is perfect. No typos or format inconsistencies. This may sound trivial, but it sends a message. If you can create your own format, adopt a layout that you think best represents the value you bring. In fact, you may want to create a one-page Kim contributions document to bring to your actual review. Prepare for the review itself. Write talking points that provide a brief summary of your year and practice them out loud. This will help you to be more fluent when the time comes without being overly rehearsed. Finally, own it. Remind yourself throughout this process that you are a valuable employee and you bring your best to this job. Bring a spirit of confidence and joy that will be infused throughout the process. And the person who wrote this is Liz Ryer, who is a credentialed coach with more than 20 years of business experience. And from Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I need advice on how to discuss a sensitive matter with my son and daughter-in-law's babysitter. She watches my grandson Monday through Friday while they are at work. They live with me and I work from home, so I'm around all day while she's sitting with the baby. Overall, she's pretty good, but we've discovered her asleep in my son and daughter-in-law's bed a couple of times. She also changes into my son's clothing occasionally, which makes my daughter-in-law very uncomfortable. My daughter-in-law needs to have a discussion about it with her, but doesn't know how to go about it. My suggestion was for her to be clear and tell the woman she's uncomfortable with the behavior and ask her to stop. What do you think? Dear Not Sitting, your daughter-in-law should ask her babysitter why she's crawling into their bed and putting on her employer's clothes, because frankly, what's going on is bizarre. The sitter should be told she's not being paid to sleep on the job, and further, that dressing up in the husband's attire is forbidden, and if it happens again, she will be replaced. And I'm going to stop right here and take a quick break, and I'll be back with part two in a couple of minutes.